This is an interview with Thomas Kim for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm Kenneth Durr. The date is October 11, 2016, and we are in Washington, D.C. I want to talk a little bit about your background. I see that you're from Ohio.
I'm really not from Ohio. I was born in Ohio.
Okay.
My father was a resident there, and then we moved to Pennsylvania when I was around 2 years old.
All right.
And I grew up in the Lehigh Valley.
Oh.
And from there, I went away to high school. I went to boarding school at the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I was in the last all-boys class. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to Yale undergrad for college, and I was an English major there. Between college and law school, I was an editorial assistant at the New York Review of Books.
Oh.
And I worked for Bob Silvers and Barbara Epstein. And that was a really interesting year because, you know, they stand at the pinnacle of publishing. They worked with all of the best writers in the world. And to interact, or in a very minor way, with Joan Didion and Hugh Trevor Roper and V.S.
Wow.
Nightfall, just even, like, you know, making calls to them, it was kind of neat. For an English major, it was a really great experience. And then from there, I went to law school at Harvard.
So you decided you didn't want to stay in the literature world?
I didn't. You know, it's kind of a tough world to be in because they pay you next to nothing.
Yeah.
And a lot of the work at the beginning is very, it's very ministerial.
Yeah.
And it's hard to, you know, really have a productive career in publishing. And so, like many English majors before me, I went to law school. But I have to say, I was probably very unprepared for law school because I hadn't taken much history in college. And I remember the first day or two of law school in which they were talking about the three branches of government. And I thought, oh, the three branches of government. I forgot what they were. And of course, it came back to me. But the point being, I wasn't, you know, engineered for law school like many of my fellow law students were.
Did you develop an interest in securities law or corporate law relatively quickly through law school?
The first year summer, I worked for Debevoise & Plimpton in Washington, and I was hired to work on an insider trading book that Ralph Ferrara, who was then a partner there and a former general counsel of the SEC, he was writing. I think the book is now called Ferrara on Insider Trading. And so as a first-year summer associate, all I did was work on this book. And so I got to know the laws of insider trading very well. But in those days, this is 92 to 95 when I was at Harvard Law School, they had very few securities professors there. And in fact, they had, you know, Detlev Watz, who was a very senior, he was actually really an international law professor, and an assistant professor now, you know, Lucian Bebchuk, who's now very well known for his work in corporate governance. So I never took securities law, actually. It was that one summer where I studied the laws of insider trading, and then after that, nothing until after I graduated. I clerked for a year in the U.S. District Court here in D.C., and then I joined Sullivan & Cromwell in their D.C. office,
okay.
And I started practicing securities law there.
Okay. Did your D.C. District Court experience, did that get you into the sort of regulatory agency stuff?
You know, we didn't actually have that many regulatory cases during my tenure. We had an IP trial. We had a lot of drug criminal cases. It was a very motley assortment of cases, although I do remember one instance where we had a TRO, and the lawyer on the case was John Roberts.
Huh.
And I remember it because I remember at the time Judge Oberdorfer, for whom my clerk said, John Roberts, you know, he was very careful about this case because he respected John Roberts so much. And I remembered that, so when he was nominated for the Supreme Court, it just brought back all of those memories.
And then you went to GE after you were at Sullivan?
No. So I was at S&C for a year, and a little bit more than a year, and this is in the days where there was no emails and no PDFs. And so as the junior associate on a transaction, you are assigned basically to handle the distributions to everybody else on the working group. And after a year of, you know, obsessing about the FedEx deadline and getting the distribution done and so on, I thought I'd had enough. And I thought entertainment law had always appealed to me. I had an opportunity to be an entertainment lawyer, so I went to Beverly Hills, and I joined the firm of Gang, Tye, Raymer, and Brown. And for the next 2 years, I did entertainment law. And I found out that it basically is doing the same contract over and over again. You know, it's employment services contract. And so after 2 years of that, I thought, well, this is fun to do when I'm, you know, in my 20s, but I can't do this in my 60s. It's just not that interesting. And so I moved back to the East Coast. I joined Latham & Watkins. And that's really when I began my securities career in earnest. My mentor there was John Huber, a former director of Portfin. He and I worked together very intensively. This was during the period in which, you know, SOX was enacted, I think, in 2002. And he and I worked very extensively on Sarbanes-Oxley, and we put out, I think, one of the first sort of comprehensive analyses of that statute. And you can still see it floating around the internet today, but it was... It was circulated quite widely. And then in 2003, I was recruited away from Latham to go to GE by my new boss, Mike McAlevey, who was a former deputy director of Portfin. And so I worked at GE for 3 years. Mike and I were really the only securities lawyers there. And we handled all of the corporate governance issues for GE, all of the SEC filings, all of the capital markets transactions. And then, because I had worked for a former deputy director, and I had at Latham worked for a former director of Portfin, that in around 2006, I think Chris Cox was nominated and then confirmed as the chair of the SEC, and his general counsel was Brian Cartwright, a former Latham partner who was based in the LA office. And I remember I was at the spring ABA meeting in 2006, and I saw John, and I, pushed him, and I brought him aside, and I we spoke privately, and I said, I'm thinking about going to the SEC, but I don't really know what the Office of the General Counsel does. I'd rather be in Portfin. And I asked him what I should do, and John said, well, the most important thing is to get in the door. Once you get into the door, you can, maneuver and, get lucky, but just get in the door. And so, with that advice, I called up Brian and I interviewed with him and I got the job as counsel to the general counsel. And it was on that basis that I moved from New York to back to D.C. To be Brian's counsel.
Okay.
And that was in June of 2006. And I worked with Brian for about 3 months until the fall of 2006, when Chris Cox named the new deputy chief of staff, and his name was Mike Halloran. Mike is the former general counsel of Bank of America, former partner at Pillsbury. And Mike and I had worked together on two editions of the Corporate Director's Guidebook that's issued by the ABA's Committee on Corporate Laws. And so when Mike came to the commission, I think in that fall, I think around October, I met with him, and I very quickly sort of transitioned from the general counsel's office to the chair's office. So I became counsel to Chris Cox, and that was the fall of 2006. And my office was right opposite Mike Halloran's office, and he put me in charge of Portfin, OCA, and I did my share of enforcement. All the counsels did their share of enforcement work. And the director of Portfin was John White, and the chief accountant was Con Hewitt. And together we had, I think, over the next 12, 15 months, an extremely productive year. If you look on the SEC website and you look at the adopted rules in that period, there was a tremendous amount that got done. And I didn't realize it at the time, but we were lucky in the sense that there was a very defined agenda that John White had. And more importantly, we had a commission at that time that worked well together. So it was Annette Nazareth, Roel Campos, Kathy, and Paul Atkins.
Right.
And, the chemistry was productive among the five of them, and so they were able to get a number of things done. And one of the most important things during that period was, by that point, 2006, SOX had been in place for over 10 years. Companies were complaining strenuously about the cost of complying with 404, which requires the audit of internal control over financial reporting. And one of Chairman Cox's main goals was to revise that audit standard that was driving costs and driving what many people viewed as unnecessary work. And so I think the most important thing that I worked on during that period was audit standard number 5. What became audit standard number 5? And the effort had been ongoing for, you know, a number of months to try to redo the audit standard. But the chair was not happy with how it was going, and so Mike and I were brought in to basically push heads together and really make a significant change to that audit standard. And neither of us were experts in auditing, but we obviously could read the audit standard and think about, you know, what conduct is the audit standard requiring. And so that was a very intensive engagement with the PCAOB staff on right-sizing audit standard number 2.
Was this essentially the one that set a specific limit for the size of companies that needed to do internal control?
No, this is the audit standard that companies had to follow and auditors applied in evaluating or auditing the internal controls over financial reporting.
Okay.
And it didn't allow for much judgment. It was a very kind of black and white audit standard, and it was interpreted by the audit firms in a very not punitive, but in a very rigorous way. And so many companies felt that they were just doing paperwork for the purpose of paperwork, just for the purpose of complying with the standard, but to no real substantive benefit, and that judgment was not allowed to be exercised or permitted to be exercised. And basically, audit standard number 5 allows companies to exercise judgment, promotes, quite frankly, the exercise of judgment and how to do the event for how audit firms can conduct their audits. And it, I think, led to, I think it led to a more efficient standard, and it really did, I think, effectively address the criticisms that have been made to date about audit standard number 2 and about 404. So today, you don't hear people talk about, you know, repealing Section 404 of SOX.
Right.
You know, we were able to right-size that audit standard. And so I think that, in my view, was one of the biggest achievements of the Cox chairmanship.
Accountants talk about principles-based versus rules-based. Is this one of those?
It was. It promoted more principles-based judgments,
right,
on what was necessary for the audit. And in addition to issuing the audit standard, the commission also issued management's guidance, because audit standard number 5 is written for the audit firm. It's an auditing standard. And management's guidance was drafted at the same time because, of course, management has to reach its own conclusions about the effectiveness of ICFR. It's that conclusion that is then audited by the audit firm. So that, among the many things that happened during that 12-month period, I do think that audit standard number 5 and the corresponding management's guidance, you know, when you look back on his chairmanship, I think is probably one of the most important things that he did.
Mm-hmm. So that would have been one of the last things that sort of put SOX behind.
I think so.
Okay. Revisions to S3 eligibility. Now, is this a small business kind of a thing?
Exactly.
And this is before 2008, so this is a...
Yes, and you're right to point to focus on 2008, because between the period from 2006 to 2008, and I left the chairman's office in November of 2007, but there was just an enormous number of rulemakings that got done, including revising S3 eligibility to allow companies with, you know, $75 million in market cap to actually use S3, reducing the holding period in Rule 144 from 2 years to 1 year, allowing companies to use electronic proxy as opposed to paper proxy statements.
Right.
I think 12G32B for foreign private issuers, allowing them to not report, was also adopted at that time. I think the change to the all holders best price rule was adopted at that time. You know, it's interesting, like within the Division of Corporation Finance, there is a draft of every possible rule proposal you could think of. At some point, somebody has thought of it, it was drafted, then it was put on the shelf. And it seems like during this period, many of these ongoing projects have been outstanding were somehow able to be proposed and then able to be adopted. So there are just a lot of projects that have been outstanding for, as I said, for a period of time. But it was, under John's leadership, a period where rules got adopted. and changes got made that I think eased the regulation of capital markets and public companies.
Was this a general focus on boosting capital formation under Cox? Was that the orientation?
It was. It was promoting capital formation. I think these were also projects that the division had long thought about, but they needed a chair, you know, a chair of the SEC to support and push those through. And between Cox and John White, they were able to do that. Of course, things changed after the financial crisis kicked into gear, but that was a productive policymaking period.
Right. So you talked about the e-proxy as well. This is also something that happened in this period.
That's right. That's right.
And that again, that's the shareholder.
I mean, e-proxy is allowing companies to post their proxy materials online. They have to send out, you know, this one page or one card saying notice of the availability of internet proxy materials. But other than that, they can use the internet to cut down distribution, publication costs associated with paper proxy statements, and, you know, and sort of take yet one more step towards the internet age when everything really is available and on the internet and relied on.
Right. And this seems kind of late for that. So was it kind of a no-brainer to sort of
I think so. And in fact, you know, thinking about it again, we probably could have done even more in terms of not even requiring the paper notice of internet availability. You know, it's interesting. The SEC has been, in many ways, a pioneer in terms of using the internet. You know, for example, they had EDGAR in the 80s, and EDGAR is now the most visited federal database and website, quite frankly. And they have been always been aware of and anticipating the use of the internet, but they've always had this hankering or notion that, you know, the paper should always be available. And, you know, the e-proxy rule that you see from 2007 still carries with it that vestige of, but there should always be paper available. And it's interesting that in 2016, I think hardly anybody sees anything in paper anymore. But I think there still is the notion that the paper version should always be available upon request or something like that.
Who's carrying that on? I mean, is that something that the chairman pushes down through the commission? Or?
I think it's just, you know, when you look at the data, the level of internet penetration in our society is quite deep now in 2016, but there's still people who don't use the internet. Yeah. And many people who are older, you know, they're senior citizens, they may not be as comfortable with computers, but they are investors. And obviously the commission takes very seriously its investor protection mandate, and so it still has the concern, and it probably will, that concern may even be there for maybe another 10 years, that there should always be paper available upon request. But certainly, you know, in the main, it's just a matter of time before that, even that vestige is no longer necessary.
Okay.
So
you've talked. We've talked a lot about some of the corp fin type of activities you undertook while you were counsel to Chairman Cox. Other, you mentioned that you had some kind of enforcement role.
Yeah, all of us, all of the counsels on the 10th floor, to the commissioners and the chair, everybody has their own share of enforcement cases where they review the memorandums submitted by enforcement, and then they analyze the recommendation made by enforcement, and then they make their own recommendation to the chair. And so even though enforcement lays that all out in a memo, at least for Chairman Cox, we wrote our own separate memo on top of that evaluating enforcement's recommendation. And given that, you know, there's a closed meeting at the commission every week, it seems, with 20, 25, you know, cases coming up for action, each person who's, you know, counseling a commissioner or chair is doing his or her share of enforcement cases.
And are you doing legal research or trying to sort of give your imprimatur to this and say that they're following
the guidance? It's always laid out by the division. Of course, you can form your own point of view, and there are certain controversial cases, although not many, but there are some controversial cases that are real judgment calls, and in those particular circumstances, you might meet with the enforcement team and to talk about the recommendation, and then you would then, you know, summarize that in your memo to your boss, and that would be part of that would be in the notebook that then the chair or the commissioner, you know, goes into the closed meeting room with. But yes, I mean, it was our job to vet those recommendations and to make sure that we were satisfied with the recommendations. And given, you know, the excellence of the enforcement division, I mean, things were pretty much wrapped up in a lovely bow and present at the time it was even presented to the 10th floor. And so our job was more confirmatory than, you know, raising new issues that nobody had spotted before. Mm-hmm. Because by the point in time it comes to the chair or to the 10th floor, remember, it's been vetted not only by enforcement but counsel for the respondent has, you know, done all the negotiations that he or she can to settle the case, and so a lot of legal work has happened by the time it comes to the commission.
Okay. So in some respects this is a formality.
It is a formality, but except in those cases where, and a very small percentage of cases in which there really is an issue where you think, should this issue be addressed in an enforcement question, or was there an open question of interpretation such that enforcement is not an appropriate way to resolve this issue? That mm-hmm. it should be done either through interpretive guidance or some sort of report by the commission, but not through an enforcement proceeding. Yeah. And those are few and far between, but they do come up, and that's sort of the job of counsel to sort of identify those issues and make sure that those get properly vetted by the chair okay. and by the commission.
One other thing we talked about being during your time as counsel was the Rule 144. Mm-hmm. And there are these themes that go throughout. And mm-hmm. this appears to be another one of those capital formation.
It was. I mean, look, we are talking about a Republican chair of the SEC who was focused on facilitating capital formation. And Rule 144, you know, which formerly had a two-year holding period before you could resell, that obviously is a disincentive to people purchasing in a private offering, because when you purchase in a private offering, you have restricted shares. And if the company is not a reporting company and you have to hold those shares for 2 years before you can freely resell, that's sort of a disincentive for anybody wanting to purchase in a private offering. And so one of the many revisions of 144 is that it reduced the two-year holding period to a one-year holding period. And that same theme is, you know, making S3 available to a smaller category of issuers. I think we also adopted smaller reporting company requirements during that same period of time to make disclosure compliance with the disclosure requirements easier for smaller companies. It's also about, you know, making it easier for foreign private issuers to get out of the reporting system by allowing them to stop reporting so long as they report in English. Pursuant to their home country rules and have those English reports available on their websites. There were a lot of those types of accommodations made during that period, and they were typically adopted 5-0. So there was really no disagreement among the commission about whether or not these were good things to do. It was just a matter of getting things done. And, you know, John White is a very goal-oriented person, and he had a list of things that he wanted to get done, and he was very effective in moving that rulemaking agenda along. You know, you look at the adopted rules during that period, and most of them are court fin rules. He was just a very efficient person.
Okay. You can clear one thing up for me. Mm-hmm. Very interesting going on here, and I think you mentioned it was this idea of foreign issuers. Is the word delisting or something like that, or deregistering? Mm-hmm. Explain what's going on there exactly.
Well, you know, it's once you become an Exchange Act listed a registered company, it's hard to get out. And we were concerned about foreign private issuers incurring the expense of Exchange Act reporting, even though they weren't themselves listed here in the U.S. And so the issue was, well, how can we allow them to get out of Exchange Act reporting, but still make sure that investors have the information they need to make investment decisions about these foreign private issuers? And so 12G32B under the Exchange Act was adopted during this period that basically said, if you're a foreign private issuer, you can stop reporting so long as you continue to report in English pursuant to the rules of your home country and you have that English version available on your website. This was a project that Paul Dudek, the former chair of the Office of International Corporate Finance, Paul left the SEC just about 6 months ago, but he had been the chief of that office for many years and was widely respected as the person on foreign private issuers. And this was a project that he had been working on for, I think, a number of years, actually. And, you know, as with these other projects, those projects were able to be to actually get proposed and adopted during this period. So same thing with the all holders best price rule. There was some concern that compensatory arrangements with the target's management teams could somehow run afoul of the all holders best price rule. The Office of M&A, then led by Brian Brehany, had been working on that rule to sort of address that concern for some period of time, and that rule was able to be proposed and adopted during this period. So, people look back and think of the Cox chairmanship, and they look at the fiscal crisis, which obviously kind of overshadowed what had come before. But before the financial crisis, it was a very productive period in terms of, getting things adopted, which I think there was, widespread agreement, was appropriate. Those changes were appropriate. It was promoting capital formation, and it was not harming investors. And so it was like a to-do list that I think was in somebody's desk that got pulled out and got adopted.
So by the time you left, and you left in late
November of 2007.
Yeah, had all those.
Most of those had been done. I think there were some that got done after I left the chair's office, but John had already created the momentum. And when I say we, my role as counsel to the chair meant that I oversaw the rulemaking agenda in CorpFin. And so I was part of, I was part of every rulemaking project.
Okay.
In some extent more than the others. It was really, of course, the career people in CorpFin who were really carrying the water. They're the ones who were really drafting it. My job as counsel was to make sure, just to oversee those projects and make sure that they were moving along, and that we were meeting deadlines. If I thought that there's an issue that we needed to get involved in, then the chair's office would get very involved on certain issues. But for the most part, it was more of oversight and just making sure that it was consistent with what we thought the chair wanted.
Okay.
But it really was the career staff that was very much, on the ground. They're the ones who are closest to the issues. And I certainly don't want to take any credit for the work that they've been doing for many, many months, if not years, on these projects. But it was just my role simply to make sure that they were all getting proposed and adopted in a timely manner.
Would you work chiefly with John White, or would you work with his people?
I worked chiefly with John, and then the heads of the various teams that were adopting, that were actually working on the rulemaking projects, but primarily with John.
Okay. So you were pretty tuned in to corporate.
I was.
At this point. So was this just a matter of you getting in the door and waiting until the?
I guess it was. So I think by November, Dave Lynn, the prior chief counsel, had left, and they were posting for that job.
Okay.
And so I applied for it. And I got the job, and so I left the chair's office around Thanksgiving of 2007, and moved down to the staff.
Okay. Why did you want to make that move? What was the attraction to get on the staff?
I think because from the chair's level, you're still not involved in the day-to-day work of the staff. You're just sort of overseeing the rulemaking agenda, but I wanted a more engaged role in the work of the division. I'd always wanted to work at the division, and it was a great opportunity for me to move down. These jobs don't come open very often. And so even though I would have liked probably another 6 months in the chair's office to sort of finish what I had been working on, the opportunity was compelling, and so I took it. And so I left. But you're right. It was kind of hard to leave the energy of the 10th floor, the rulemaking agenda being part of Chairman Cox's office, and then to move down to the staff and then work on the day-to-day work of the office of the chief counsel, which is involved with answering questions from the public about how the securities law should be interpreted and applied, and working on the interpretive work of the division. Mm-hmm. So you're no longer really making rules, but you're really just sort of actively interpreting those rules.
Right.
And so one of the things that one of the assignments that John gave me when I became chief counsel was he wanted to update all of the telephone interpretations that we had. And so that was my big project when I first came to court, to the chief counsel's office, was taking all of the prior telephone interpretations over decades, reviewing all of them, seeing whether or not I agreed with them, and then revising them if I needed to, and then basically republishing all of those interps. And so that was basically a 2-3 year process. Wow. But it was part of John's overall effort. You know, he liked to say, you know, on the side of New York City police cars, they have CPR, courtesy, professionalism, and respect. And that was kind of his motto of how he wanted the division to engage with the public. And part of his effort was, you know, to promote compliance with the federal securities laws. You have to understand how those laws are interpreted. And that's why we would use the vehicle of these compliance and disclosure interpretations, not only to get our interpreted positions out there, but also to promote compliance. Because it had been, you know, before the internet, you know, insiders at the SEC had an advantage, and former insiders, alumni, had an advantage over private law firm practitioners who had never been at the SEC, because there had developed over the years, over the decades, kind of this administrative common law of how the federal securities laws are interpreted by the staff. And you didn't know that secret language or the secret interps unless you had actually been there. And so that's why the staff started publishing telephone interps, but it wasn't really in any kind of systematic way. And so this effort of updating all the interpretive guidance in the commission, in the division, was his effort to really systematize and make sure that all of this learning that had built up over the years, all of that was now made available to the public. And
what's a telephone interpretation?
A telephone interp is, you know, there's actually a telephone number that you can call even today, and you leave a voicemail, and somebody will return your call. And it, you know, it could be some lawyer asking, like, how, you know, a question about S3 eligibility or how 144 works. And then what each counsel does is they keep a log of all of the questions and answers that they've given. And then those questions and answers are then, they're maintained. There's a log of those so that the office can keep track of its interpretations, and so that there can be within the office consistency of interpretation. And every so often, you know, the staff would have published those telephone interps. But it was not in any systematic way, and you never knew whether or not a telephone interp from like 10 years ago was still a good interp or not. And oftentimes, they were very fact-intensive, and so if you had a slightly different fact pattern, you wouldn't know whether or not you were still covered by the interp or not, because there wasn't much explanation. It was just sort of, this was the fact pattern, and this was our answer. And so these CD dives were sort of an attempt to sort of take what had already been published and to see whether or not we can make them more generic, more general, because they'd be more useful that way. And we could try to highlight the legal interpretation or principle at issue. So what was relevant, what wasn't relevant. And so that was, you know, a 2 or 3 year project to really transform what had sort of been, it wasn't unorganized, but basically to update all of those interps.
So this was like boiling millions of words down into thousands or something like that?
Something like that, yes. You know, it was great work. It was a great project for me, because since I was new to the division, I wasn't new to, you know, the federal securities laws, but being new to the division, it was a great way for me to sort of think about the division's interpretive positions, right, whether I agreed with them. If I didn't agree, why did I not agree? And then to sort of really try to figure out what was the right view. And so it was a great learning process for me. And I think it was good for everybody to really kind of focus on, let's make sure that what we have out there is a valid interpretation and can be relied on. And as I was doing this, Wayne Carnall, who was the new chief accountant of the division, was undertaking a very similar project in putting together what is now the financial reporting manual. I think it had already been there. You know, it had already been published internally, but never externally. And his effort was to take what had been an internal document and to have that published, so that everybody could be aware of the staff's views on how various SX provisions were to be applied. So that was his corresponding effort on the SX side of things, to make sure that the public understood the division's views about what financial statements were required and all of the variants that the financial reporting manual addressed. But it was a division-wide effort in both of those two areas.
Okay. Let's get to this question of law, the certification of questions of law in the Delaware court. Mm-hmm. That was intriguing to me. I had a really hard time, mm-hmm. Getting to what exactly was going on there.
So in 2007 and 2008, during that time period, Brian Cartwright, the general counsel, had lunch with the justices of the Delaware Supreme Court. And as I recall him recounting to me, it was about, how can the Delaware bar interact more productively with the SEC? And I think Brian's thought was, well, why don't you, if we ever have a question of state law, it would be great to actually get, the views of the Delaware Supreme Court. And so I think the Supreme Court members took that back, and the Delaware General Assembly actually amended the Constitution of Delaware to authorize the Supreme Court to certify questions of law submitted to it by the SEC.
Did the SEC request that?
Literally just, I think, a conversation that Brian had as the general counsel of the commission. His thought was, look, if there were to be state corporate law questions, and usually they typically are Delaware questions,
right,
it would be great to have the Delaware Supreme Court be able to hear those questions of law, because the SEC obviously is not authorized and has no expertise in how the Delaware general corporation law should be interpreted. And yet so many public companies are Delaware companies, and increasingly, increasingly the SEC is involved in issues of corporate governance. And so the Delaware General Assembly had amended the Constitution, and so Brian said to me, well, if there should ever be an opportunity, let's use it. And so I said, fine, that's interesting. And I had a lot of friends in the Delaware bar. And then shortly thereafter, I actually found the perfect opportunity. And that arose in a shareholder proposal submitted by the AFSCME pension plan to CA Inc. I think it was formerly known as Computer Associates Inc. And the shareholder proposal proposed to amend the bylaws to require the board of directors to pay the cost of any successful proxy contest. And so CA, represented by Sullivan Cromwell and Richard Layton and Finger, said that the proposal should be excludable because it would cause CA to violate state law, and therefore was excludable on that basis under 14A8. I think it's I-2 or I-3, I forget which one is about violation of law. And they accompanied their no-action request with an opinion by Richard Layton and Finger, the well-known Delaware firm. So then AFSCME, for its part, responded to the no-action request and said, we disagree with you. And here's the legal opinion by our law firm, Grant and Eisenhofer, a well-known, highly respected plaintiff's firm based in Delaware. And they opine that the subject matter of the proposal, which was to amend the bylaws to authorize, or rather require, the board of directors to pay the expenses of any successful proxy contest, they said that it was a suitable matter for a shareholder. It was a suitable matter for a bylaw, and that it would not cause the board of directors to violate the law, or the company to violate the law, if it was adopted. And because we had competing legal opinions on a question of Delaware law, the company had not met its burden to persuade the staff to issue no action relief. And so we had, because we had these competing questions of competing opinions, the question was, what should we do? And I thought, well, let's use the certification process. And so, I called the general counsel's office up and I said to Brian, I think we actually have something. And with their guidance, my deputy John Ingram and I worked, actually for about over a weekend to sort of put together our recommendation to the commission to certify these questions to the Delaware Supreme Court. It had never been done before. The commission received the recommendation from Court Finn, and they approved it. And so we issued So they formally certified these questions to the Delaware Supreme Court.
What does that mean, certified? They're not bringing a case in the Supreme Court, right?
Right, they're not bringing a case. It's just a pure question of law that the SEC has requested guidance on.
Okay.
So they, you know, so the commission itself, the five members, approved the request to certify these questions, and then in turn, because the Delaware Supreme, the Delaware General Assembly had amended the Constitution to authorize the Supreme Court to hear questions of law certified to it by the SEC, then it, of course it was up to the Delaware Supreme Court to decide whether or not to accept the certification.
Right.
And they accepted the certification on July 1st. And I remember very clearly when they did that, I thought, gosh, well, you know, I need to inform the parties of what I've done. In other words, here they thought that they were doing this typical no-action process, which is a typical low-cost process. It's a purely administrative. They write the request, and then, the shareholder proponent, responds. And usually that's the end of it. And here I had basically transformed it into a judicial proceeding. And so I called up counsel and for both, and I was initially very concerned that they would say, well, we're not going to play ball with this. All we wanted was a no-action request. We hereby withdraw the request. But it's funny, I was talking to David Harms, who is the lawyer at Sullivan Cromwell, and I think he later told me that I caught him when he was like in the car. But when I called him, I said, David, I have certified these questions to the Delaware Supreme Court, and so now you're going to have to brief and argue this case to the Supreme Court. He was very nonplussed about it, and he later told me that it wasn't until sometime afterwards they thought, just what has happened? And when I called, I forget who I called, at Grant and Eisenhower, was it Grant or Eisenhower, but they too were very nonplussed about it. And so, they both accepted the change in form, so to speak. And, I just reprinted the case and read the opinion again just to remind myself of the dates. But the court accepted certification on July 1st, and it was briefed in a week, and the matter was argued on July 9th, almost like 8 days later. And then the Supreme Court acted and issued its opinion on July 17, 8 days later, when everybody was acting on an expedited basis because CA had to publish its proxy statement, and they had their annual meeting, in like a month and a half, and so we were working on their schedule, but we had acted very quickly, the commission had acted quickly, the parties willingly, met the briefing and argument schedule handed. Issued by the court, and then the court in turn issued its own opinion within 2 weeks.
Amazingly quick.
It's amazingly quick. Everybody acting very cooperatively, and we have in the form of an opinion now by the Supreme Court their view on what an appropriate matter, what an appropriate shareholder-sponsored bylaw is. And that's a question of law that we probably wouldn't have been, that probably would not have been adjudicated had it not been for this very strange posture in which they're not applying the law to fact. There's no case or controversy. They're being asked to just focus on, there is a fact pattern in that there is a specific proposal, but that's really all there is.
So this gives you something to build on in the future.
Yes, it does. Although I don't think, the process has not been used. I mean, because if you think about it, how often is there a real state law issue that the commission or its staff needs to deal with, mm-hmm. such that it would certify a question to the Delaware Supreme Court? Maybe it might come up maybe in an enforcement context, I suppose, but it's hard to see how those types of questions get arise. It just so happened that soon after the Delaware Constitution was amended, we did have this sort of perfect fact pattern with these dueling state law opinions such that we could use this new certification process. And I think Delaware, for its part, was very open to this. After all, they were the ones who had amended their constitution. And so I don't think I had any real question that they would accept the questions because they were very interesting questions. Mm-hmm. And, they issued their opinion in a very expedited manner. So I think it was obviously novel for everybody. But I think at the end of the day, people would say it was a good process. In other words, that there was a question of state law, an open question that actually mattered because it would result in whether or not CA had to include this proposal in its practice statement or not. And, you know, the right body decided that question, the Delaware Supreme Court.
How would CorpFin have dealt with this if that door hadn't been opened?
They would have denied the request for no action relief. They would have said, you haven't met your burden. Yes, you have a legal opinion from Richard Layton, but I have in hand a legal opinion from Grant Eisenhofer, and I have no way to decide which one is correct. And so, therefore, you haven't met your burden, so you've got to include the proposal in the proxy statement.
Okay.
And as I recall, it was not drafted in a precatory way, so if I don't recall that it was. So if it had actually gotten more than 50% of the outstanding votes, it would have become a bylaw provision in CEA's bylaws.
Hmm.
So, I mean, I do think that it had a material impact, at least on that proposal. I think, obviously, you know, the Supreme Court's principal issue was it didn't allow, the proposed bylaw as written did not allow directors to exercise their fiduciary duty. So I probably the next year they just, you know, added a sentence allowing directors to exercise their fiduciary duty, and thereby, you know, it could be adopted. But in any event, it was material for that particular year's proxy statement.
Okay. What were you working on in CorpFin in 2008 when the financial crisis started to hit?
Well, this was 2008.
Okay.
And what I was also working on the interpretive release on the use of company websites.
Okay.
You know, when I was running the chief counsel's office, I always like to have a number of projects going on to sort of really challenge ourselves. And so in addition to the day-to-day work of the office answering questions from the public, we had this project to update all of our interpretations. I would get involved in certain rulemakings that I thought made sense for the office. And we were also working on this interpretive release. This was initially a recommendation by the advisory committee, CIFR, I think the Committee on Improving Financial Reporting. And they approved this recommendation. And I remember Amy Starr, who had been sort of advising CIFR, she came to me and said, well, you've got to now write an interpretive release. And I said, well, what interpretive release? She's like, well, you know, we had to come up with a recommendation. We came up with this recommendation. They've approved it, and now we have to do it. And I just thought to myself, oh, you know, what should we do now? So over the course of a weekend, I just drafted the interpretive release. And so it addressed how companies could use their websites to post information and have that information be viewed as having been publicly disseminated for purposes of Regulation FD and even for purposes of insider trading law. And so it really kind of explored, you know, the legal analysis for how we treat information posted on a company's website. To kind of encourage companies to do that. And a number of commission rules today had actually encouraged the use of websites, you know. And so the interpretive release sort of analyzed the way the commission had been using websites more or less as a supplement to EDGAR. But in one or two cases, they did view a company's website as a replacement to EDGAR, like 12G32B, the foreign private issuers. You know, if they put something on their website, then they don't have to file anything on EDGAR. So there's a number of ways in which the commission was sort of supplementing its own database, EDGAR, with company websites. And I think today, I think many companies not only file their SEC filings, they're actually required to put, you know, their SEC filings online on their websites if they have one. And there are a lot of ways in which information that would otherwise be required on EDGAR is now on a company's website, like the audit committee charter, for example.
Okay.
Your code of ethics and whether or not you allow or have any waivers of the code of ethics. So over time, there has been sort of like this supplementation of EDGAR with company websites. This interpretive release was sort of addressing that phenomenon and giving some making some principles about how companies should think about it. And so that was yet another thing. But you're right, during the financial crisis, it was primarily affecting trading and markets and other aspects of the commission. Not CorpFin so much. I mean, there was obviously concern about the various issuers, and I was involved in thinking about, well, what should happen in the event of X, Y, or Z, and how do we help these registrants if they were to be in distress. So as an alternative to bankruptcy, could we do like a good bank, bad bank separation? I mean, you know, people were thinking or trying to be creative because, you know, you could see on the horizon what was happening. But it wasn't really a Court Finn issue so much as it was the other division. So for my part, I really kind of kept my head down. And aside from advising on these particular proposed transactions, we just started, you know, kept up with the work of the division.
Okay. So we get to the, I think, the proxy plumbing thing starts to
Yeah, so the financial crisis happens in 2008. It really kind of crests in 2008. And, you know, when Mary Shapiro became chair, I mean, proxy assets have been on the table for any number of years. It's always been looked at, then put aside, then looked at. And she very much wanted to do proxy access. That was a priority for her and her leadership of the commission. And so from 2008 to 2009, 2010, the staff was very hard at work on a rule proposal and then a rule adoption on proxy access.
What, John White once said that proxy shareholder access was the elephant in the room. And Why was that exactly? And you said that it had been an issue for a long time.
Well, when you think about the power of shareholders, I mean, it's really very limited. They have no ability to manage the company. Their one power is to elect directors. That power, that right to elect directors, is circumscribed by, well, who's actually been nominated for director, who are the nominees, and because, you know, unless I have some choice of the nominee, then my election right is not that meaningful. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you can nominate directors, and many companies have bylaws that set forth how you can actually nominate somebody, but to have them be included in the proxy statement, that's actually where the action is. Because it's one thing to nominate somebody, but if that nomination can't be voted on by anybody else because it's not included in the proxy statement, then what's the point?
Yeah.
And so the point has always been, you know, how can shareholders get their nominees, if they have one, in the company's proxy statement? Yes, they could run their own proxy contest. They can have their own proxy statement, their own proxy card, and run a competing proxy solicitation, but that does take money and time, but mostly money. And so, it was sort of seen as, you know, well, just, you know, why can't they include them in the company's proxy statement? And they just add, you know, on the proxy card, there's like an extra square for the shareholder's nominee's name. And of course, companies have been resisting this because they are very focused or concerned about competing proxy statements. They're very focused on keeping control of the board or making sure that they know who's going to be on the board. And they weren't going to just simply allow shareholders to put their own nominees on the company's proxy statement and proxy card. And so, but with Mary Shapiro's chairmanship of the SEC, she thought that it was important as a governance mechanism that this be able to occur. And so, Meredith Cross, who is her division director, and a rule writing team that quite frankly had actually worked on this for like 10 years.
Wow.
They were finally employed to sort of, finally, we're going to do proxy access. So Brian Breheny, the deputy director, I worked on the rule in some parts. We also had hired during this period Larry Harrimesh as an attorney fellow. Larry is one of the experts of Delaware corporation law. He's a professor in Delaware. And so we engaged him to be an attorney fellow, and Larry spent a lot of time working on proxy access and thinking about it from a Delaware standpoint, and so we made sure that we had that aspect vetted. And of course, it was a highly controversial rule. Even when it was adopted in 2010, it was then challenged by, I think, the Chamber of Commerce, and it was successfully challenged. And I think a year or two later, that rule was vacated by the D.C. Circuit. But as we were focusing on proxy access, there were many issues during that rulemaking process in which people said, you can't have proxy access because there are so many problems about the proxy process, such that, you know, please don't introduce what many people thought would be highly, disturbing, proxy access without first fixing all of the things that had been identified as being problematic in terms of the proxy mechanics process.
Is this within the SEC?
No, it was within the SEC, but it was more that, you know, in order to have an adopted, a final rule, you need a rule proposal. And, you know, when you looked at the comment letters that were written in response to the proxy access proposal, a lot of those comment letters pointed out all these issues having to do with the proxy mechanics that, in their view, had to be resolved first before proxy access.
Okay.
And the commission's view was, well, look, we're not going to postpone proxy access to address all these so-called problems, but what we will do is address what commenters have said in this concept release. And rather than have, you know, these comments be issued in the context of a different rule proposal on proxy access, we will squarely pose the questions to the public. You know, we've heard all of these issues about proxy mechanics and proxy advisory firms and empty voting and so on. Give us your views. And so I think so I was responsible for that concept release on the proxy mechanics. It sort of tagged alongside proxy access, and quite frankly, it was the justification or part of the justification for why the commission could adopt proxy access, because it had already, prior to that point, issued the concept release. So it was going to get public feedback on the issues identified during the comment process.
Where did the term proxy plumbing come from?
You know, I don't recall, because the release itself doesn't talk about proxy plumbing.
Yeah.
Maybe insiders just sort of use that, because it really is kind of convoluted in terms of how the broker-dealers deal with Broadridge and how votes get cast and at where do they get cast and so on. So
yeah.
It is kind of a convoluted process. So, but I don't think the release itself uses that term. But what's interesting is, so we posed all these questions, and yet the comments were really very much of a mixed bag in term, and you know, you haven't seen any kind of project built on the proxy mechanics concept release. I think the most the staff has done is that there, after I left, there were a couple interps issued with respect to investment advisors and whether or not they're legally obligated to vote on every matter. In sort of, if they were obligated to vote on every agenda item of public company proxy statements. And basically, this interp basically said no, that it was consistent with their fiduciary duty not to vote on every matter contained in the public company's agenda. And then I think it also addressed conflicts of interest by proxy advisory firms. So that's really the only thing that I can point to that really is an outgrowth of that concept release. The other thing that was sort of a hot button issue, in addition to, you know, how do we regulate proxy advisory firms, was the printing of proxy statements by Broadridge. And they more or less have a monopoly on that. And there are a lot of industry participants that did not want Broadridge to have that monopoly or near monopoly. And so there's a lot of focus on Broadridge's role as proxy distributor and publisher and whether or not that should be changed. And but you know, a lot of questions were raised. But you know, it turned out that no change was made. And I think shortly after I left, the Division of Trading and Markets approved the NYSE new fare card in terms of proxy fees. And so, you know, today in 2016, life is the same as it was back in 2010. But for a time, there was a period in which the staff had placed open for public comment, should we be making changes to the system? But basically, the feedback from investors was, it's not broken, so don't fix it.
It's complicated.
But it's not broken.
Yeah.
There's no problem. The people who really don't like it are the competitors of Broadridge. Well, you know, that's really not whom this whole system is designed to benefit. For the benefit of investors, and it seemed to be working pretty well. And so it kind of came down basically to a whimper. But on the other hand, I do think that in the process of doing the concept release, the staff did make outreach efforts to the proxy advisory firms, also to Broadridge, and I think they have continued those outreach relationships. So even if there's no actual regulation going on, there's a version of soft regulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they reach out and they call the proxy advisory firm, or they call the Broadridge. There were some instances in which, you know, the staff would actually call Broadridge and say, we've heard this complaint, please deal with it. Or a company would complain to us about, to the staff about a particular report or recommendation made by the proxy advisory firm. In some instances, we thought they might have a point, so we called up the proxy advisory firms and said, you know, you need to be responsive to these issues. You just simply can't say pound sand, you know, or we'll need to regulate you more if you don't show more responsiveness. They're not telling the advisory firms what to do as a substantive matter, but they're saying you need to be more responsive to the public company constituency. So if that's all that comes out of the concept release, then so be it. But
I want to touch on a couple more things
before
we run out of time here. Dodd-Frank is going through now. This is later.
Now this is 2010, exactly. Now we have the Dodd-Frank rulemaking project.
So you're working on a listing standards rule. Now, listing standards are for the exchanges to make, right?
Right, but it starts with a statutory directive that the commission adopt a rule, and that then the rule then directs the exchanges to modify their listing standards to comply with the statutory directive.
Okay.
And so, yes, I mean, I was involved in sort of many of the Dodd-Frank issues, but I steered clear of conflict minerals and mining and so on, because I just did not view those as being core to what CorpFin does. But compensation is something core to what the division does, and in fact, my office, you know, was responsible for executive compensation rulemaking, in part because we had the expertise in the office, Ann Krauskopf, who is a senior special counsel, who's highly respected and is terrific, and she really kind of, you know, handles a lot of these exec comp matters. And so we did that rulemaking within our office. But I try to keep, quite frankly, I try to keep the chief counsel's office out of much of Dodd-Frank because I didn't view it as being very relevant to the work of the division. And so, unfortunately, the rulemaking teams were quite small, the ones who shouldered the burden of doing conflict minerals and you know, resource extraction and so on, and they really had a terrific burden to carry, but they did it very well. But not my office.
There's not a lot of gray area in there. You're just figuring out how to implement what...
Correct, exactly. I mean, there were some policy decisions in terms of the listing companies. But no, I think in those rulemaking projects, I mean, there were a number of decisions that they had to make. I think they were very complex rulemakings, actually. I know Meredith Cross, who was director at the time, I know she spent a tremendous amount of time having to implement those two directives, or those directives on that seemed sort of unrelated to the business of corporation finance. But then the Jobs Act, which was adopted and enacted in 2012, we were much more involved. And we had actually been thinking about those issues for some time. You know, the idea of the prohibition on general solicitation and private offerings. I think we all recognize by 2010, 2012, that in the day and age of the internet and Twitter and so on, when it's so easy for information to be made public, that to have a prohibition against general solicitation in private offerings, that you know, it's just not a very tenable requirement. And increasingly so, given how easy it is for anybody to make a general solicitation. I think when the Securities Act was enacted back in the 30s, obviously to make a general solicitation required significant effort. You'd have to, you know, get on the radio or, you know, publish something in the newspaper, whereas today it's so easy. And so we had already been working on a concept release about getting rid of the prohibition on general solicitation, but then, you know, our efforts were preempted by Congress in the Jobs Act. They were acting on recommendations made by this advisory committee to the Treasury. And the Jobs Act directed the SEC to eliminate the prohibition on general solicitation in Rule 506. And so I converted the concept release that I was working on into a proposing release. And actually, we actually started off as an interim final rule release. You know, when I met with the general counsel's office, and I spoke to David Fredrickson, who has now since become my successor as chief counsel, but he was assigned to CorpFin. And we were talking about, well, how do we, you know, do this rulemaking? And he said, well, given how simple it is to implement this, I mean, we just simply strike out this sentence, why don't we simply start with an interim final rule? So it would go immediately effective. Of course, there would be a period of time in which it would, you know, after publication in the Federal Register, but it would become effective, and we would have a corresponding notice and comment period even while it was effective. And so that's what we were working on for a number of months. We would go straight to interim final, and the Republican commissioners loved that idea, and it somehow got out that we were working on an interim final rule. And the other reason why we were focusing on interim final was I think we had something like 90 days to do this. It was a completely unrealistic time period, and so we could try to accomplish that through interim final. But I think various investor advocates got wind of what we were doing and put significant pressure on Chair Shapiro to actually have a proposing release, then an adopting release, that those efforts got forestalled, and then it was converted into a proposing release. But that whole sort of transition from interim final to proposing was highly controversial. I think there are actually hearings in Congress about it. The Republicans in the House were very upset about that. You know, the Republican commissioners who are, you know, they tend to be more focused on promoting capital formation than the Democratic commissioners. I think they were also very upset because they didn't think it was such a big deal to simply do what we were proposing to do. I'm saying this all because I do think it is part of why, when it was finally adopted in 2013, in July, you know, it didn't come out with the fanfare that you would have expected. In part because there was all this baggage around it, in part created by the fact that we wanted to do interim final. It then really kind of provoked in the comment period a lot of very angry, negative comments by various state commissioners and investor advocates that said, you know, the sky's going to fall if we're going to have allow general solicitation. We're going to have private offerings advertised on the radio and on TV, and we're all going to be defrauded. And so that whole sort of process led to the issuance of a proposing release on the same day that we adopted the 506 release. And the proposing release to amend 506 further contained in it all of the ideas, comments that had been raised by commenters. You know, the mandatory Form D filings, eliminate the ability to rely on 506 if you didn't file the Form D, and all of these things were designed to make 506 more onerous than it otherwise was. Mm-hmm. And I think the combination of all of this controversy plus the proposing release, and of course the bad actor release was also adopted on that date, I think the bar just kind of looked at 506C and said, we're not interested. You know, not seeing the requirement to verify that purchasers are accredited investors, we like things the way it was before. And so that's why you have not seen, with respect to what I thought was the centerpiece of the Jobs Act, which was this change in 506, it has not become the dominant method of raising capital that we otherwise thought was going to happen. And I think in large part it was attributable to this, you know, it's the history of the rulemaking process and not the negative feelings. It's not that they're negative feelings, but it just fed into a negative perception that it was much more burdensome to do than life before the amendments.
Interesting.
So, yeah, now we have, you know, since I left, they've, you know, enacted, or rather adopted, the other Jobs Act directives. But those other directives, whether it's regulation crowdfunding or regulation A+, they are more heavily regulated than 506C. Which simply allows, you know, you to do a private placement, and you can use general advertising so long as you take reasonable steps to verify that the purchasers are in fact accredited investors. So it'll be interesting to see in terms of 5 or 10 years from now what offering method becomes dominant in terms of outside of the register process.
Had 506 gone through by the time you decided to leave?
Yes, and in fact, I stayed on as long as I did to see it through.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was adopted. The meeting was July of 2013, and then I left in August of 2013.
Okay. Well, yeah. Tell me a little bit about the decision to leave.
Well, you know, I mean, I had gone to the SEC not intending to stay as long as I did, but I had a great opportunity when I became chief counsel, and I was there for 6 years. And at some point, I thought, well, you know, there was another change in the directorship. Now Keith Higgins was on board. And I thought, well, do I want to keep doing this? I was, you know, I think I was around 43 at the time. And I thought, well, I either make a change now or this is my career. Uh-huh. And so I decided to make the change.
Okay.
So, you know, it's really not that, you know, more interesting than that.
Yeah, well...
You know, it's a life decision that everybody makes. That,
right.
You know, at some point you realize, oh, I'm getting older and I only have so much runway left, and so what do you want to do for the remaining 15 years or something
right.
like that?
Right. Well, terrific. I think this covers everything that was on my agenda. And
oh, great.
I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to interview me.
All right.